Hello and welcome to the Old Man Orange Podcast. I'm Spencer Scott Holmes.
And I'm Ryan Dunnigan.
Yeah, we're going back in time with another kind of a Once Upon a Time film. It felt like after doing that, you know, the novel of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it's kind of like, hey, we should revisit some of those other, like, Once Upon a Time movies, you know? And if you're going to revisit any of those, you better go with Once Upon a Time in the West.
Well, yeah, it was one of those things where reading that made me nostalgic for a lot of movies. Because the thing is, it may sound weird, but like, well, first off, this seems like a movie we would have covered like a few years ago, but just never got around to it.
Yeah, I know. It's weird because I'm like, when we just did Fistful of Dollars, I'm like, do we do any of the other ones? Do we do For a Few Dollars More before? I felt like we did.
When we did Yojimbo and Fistful of Dollars, I think that was actually the first time on the show. Not the first time we talked about Sergio Leone, but the first time we did an episode focused on Sergio Leone.
Yeah, because I mean, I know it's like come up in conversation, but not something that was targeted, which is that was kind of odd because I'm like, those like those kind of movies that, you know, it feels like the second you sort of get into filmmaking, like those kind of movies like come up and you're just like how cool they are and just the way they're shot and all the fun details about them. And the fact that they also are those kind of movies, when you watch them, you're like, you know what? If you just have the right, you know, area, you could almost do something similar.
Maybe not the whole, like...
Maybe not Once Upon a Time in the West. Once Upon a Time in the West is a little bit,
That one's a bit more ambitious.
Yeah. But, I mean, when you watch Fistful of Dollars or something like that, you kind of have... It has that feeling of, like, I just happen to have this one bit of town that would let me use it. If I happen to be, like, Robert Rodriguez and I just happen to know a town in Mexico...
Yeah. And everybody was really eager to help out.
I know, that's always the thing. It's like, I will say, like, I love Robert Rodriguez. That's probably, like, one of my favorite directors of all time. If not my, you know, all-time favorite director, just because of, like, all the stuff he does. But when you do read that book on, like, El Mariachi, everything's just kind of like, he's got a friend, he's got a camera, he knows his town that he goes to, and everybody's down, and they're cool, and they just want to star in it, because it's just that time period where, you know, it's that, where movies are still kind of cool. You know, I felt like the second that, like, the digital era kind of came, it was just like, yeah, whatever, everybody's making a movie. Like, what's so special about yours?
Makes you so fucking special, yeah?
Yeah.
You got dreams, so does everybody.
Like, yeah, when Robert Rodriguez comes storming in with a 16mm camera, they're like, oh, this is business. This means business now, you know what I mean?
I don't want to backtrack too far, but I do feel like the second we are in a movie theater and there is that really panderish, this goes back like 8, maybe 10 years ago, there is that really stupid panderish, it was either like a Pepsi or a Coca-Cola ad, where it's just like, we worked with some of the best film students from UCLA and YouTube creators, and it just shows like this video of just people that like fresh out of high school working on like just like computers and adjusting cameras and lights to make this commercial right here. And that's where like Megan Turney comes in to like do like single out the I'm all about that bass, out that bass, yeah. that stupid fucking song. And like, I was just like, yeah, what's the point? Apparently, that's the new Coca-Cola. It's literally the new Coca-Cola making movies.
Yeah,
we ain't special. We lost all our individuality. What can we do?
Yeah, just like, yeah, well, those two, it's like, what they call it, it's like, oh, we're working with, like, independent filmmakers, like, UCLA, like, no, that's like the rich kids that want to make movies, that's where they go to, you know, it's not fucking Steven Spielberg land anymore, it's not even like, you know, when all, like, the other guys were there, it's when it was just kind of like, because I feel like when you hear, like, when, like, George Lucas went to school and so on, like, in some of those areas for, like, you know, he was only there for, like, 6 months, that's the thing, too, is there's, like, many of those places where they're like, oh, my God, he got his education, he's like, no, he was there for, like, a moment, he probably needed to borrow a camera, so he signed up for some classes, and then kind of worked his way through. But it sounds like back in those days, it was like, yeah, we got this movie class in the back corner, you know, we got some angry director guy from the 40s that's gonna like yell at you kids about what you should be watching, and that's the class.
Pull up a seat, don't feel obligated to write it down, it's not important,
because I remember that's like what Martin Scorsese said about like when he was in like New York, he's like, yeah, that's all, really, film school didn't teach you anything about making a movie, it just was like some old director guys telling you what you should be watching, you know, it just like the style and things that he likes, it had like nothing to do with actually filmmaking itself.
I feel like it was either, whenever I took a film class, I felt like it was either that or just someone reading out of a, can't even think of the word right now, textbook, saying, okay, to edit, now we're going to do exactly what the textbook says on how to edit. And, you know, there's of course, good things to bring in there, but they literally had stock footage from the textbook that you're supposed to edit this particular way. I'm like, can we film our own thing and then do this technique? Like, no, we got to use the stock footage in this. I'm like, this is what I paid money for. Great.
Or then there's multimedia from high school where the teacher just was going to teach you literally the multimedia spectrum of life, and we were going to learn about audio recording and music making and commercials and podcasts, God forbid, you know, and everything else known to mankind. But then when movies got on the board, it was just like a bunch of pack of wild animals came in. Movies. And then he just kind of gave up. He's like, fuck it. You know, they don't want to learn graphic design. They don't want to learn coding. Movies.
It just became Woodstock 99. That's basically what that class became.
It's just like, here, you know what? As long as nobody gets poked in the eye, just here's a Sony Handycam. Just make something, anything. I don't know. Just get out of here for an hour and 20 minutes and come back with something.
And I think watching, because it kind of goes back to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood to an extent, because it goes to Tarantino, watching Kill Bill and just getting into film class, and then suddenly being kind of like, well, he makes a lot of movie references and this and that. Let me look more into his work. And then let me look into the things that inspired him. And I said when we covered Yojimbo and Fistful of Dollars that Fistful of Dollars was one, like, I wonder if this one's any good. Just the first Western I bought. Just like...
Well, like top tier of like the stack, but you just didn't know what you were getting into. Yeah, you just found like gold, just happened to stumble across it.
Yeah. It's like if you're going to get a David Bowie album, might as well start with like Ziggy Stardust. If you're getting an album that's not like a best of or something like that. You know what I mean? Or if you're getting...
Exile on Main Street by like Rolling Stones.
Exactly. It's something kind of like you're already getting one of the best albums, and without realizing it, you already got one of the best ones right there. And so from there, then just kind of falling down this water, like not just like Westerns, but just like different genres, like whether it be like really art school type shit, or whether it be just like low budget grindhouse, like slasher shit. That's where kind of I think our early 20s, and we kind of took in the most. And that's definitely when I saw Once Upon a Time in the West and loved it, and maybe watched it only 3 times before doing this show, but I probably only really watched it in that whole space of like early 20s. Like that's probably the whole time I really watched that thing. And I'm like, you know what? I remember who lives. I remember who dies. I remember certain scenes, but I don't remember the flow of this movie. So going into it, it kind of jogged my memory. Like, you know what? This is definitely one of Sergio Leone's best movies right here. This is probably better than some of the Dollars movies.
Yeah, this is that one, too, that, like, I probably hadn't seen in at least over 10 years. And, you know, this probably was, Brett, like, the third time I've seen it, you know. Because it is kind of one of those long movies and so on like that. And it's just like, I'm like, okay, I remember Charles Bronson, Harmonica Man. You know, we got Henry Fonda in there. I know he's, like, the bad guy. And then there's the lady and so on. But I couldn't... The story and everything else, it was kind of like, oh, yeah, I totally forgot about how this kind of went down. You know, it's like, I remember the intro pretty darn well and so on, but yeah, this is, like, one of those movies that's almost, like, about as perfectly kind of made as it can be. Like, I'll say, I don't think it's Sergio Leone's best movie, but, I mean, he's only got, like, 7 movies, so it's kind of weird when you think about it.
Yeah, let's see. Well, he has...
He's got 2 trilogies, and then he's got that one, like, Sword and Sandals movie, like the Colossus or whatever.
Yeah. Well, he's got, yeah.
I've always wanted to see that. I've never seen it before, but.
Because he has, I don't know, I think Once Upon a Time in the West came first. But yeah, Once Upon a Time in the West, Duck You Sucker, and Once Upon a Time in America, which that's the only one of his movies I haven't seen, aside from the Sword and Sandals one, actually.
Yo, you gotta see Once Upon a Time in America. That one definitely is. So it's one of those, like, very hardcore dramas. Like, you know,
I believe it.
You know, it's one of those ones. Robert De Niro's gonna do some shit that you're not gonna be proud of Robert De Niro for doing.
Well, you know, it was the 20s or whatever, right? Yeah. Is it a 20s movie or a 30s movie?
I think it starts off at, like, the turn of the century, and then it kind of goes into, like, the 20s and 30s or something like that. But because it spans a long time. You know, the movie's, like, 4 hours and something minutes long, too. It's, like, super fucking long.
Jewish mafia in New York in the 20s. Yeah. What made me, like, I thought this was going to be a real easy watch. Wow.
Well, it's funny, too, because, like, that was the movie, like, when Sergio only finished, like, Good, Bad, and the Ugly, he was kind of like, yeah, okay, you know, kind of done with the Western thing. I mean, it's fun, but Jesus Christ, I've been doing, like, 3 of them just, like, back-to-back-to-back-to-back. I want to try, you know, I want to do this, like, you know, Jewish gangster one and so on. And then when Paramount came by, like, no, you ain't fucking doing that. We got you over here to shoot in America. You're going to do another fucking Western. put that fucking script aside. We don't. Nobody wants to see those Jewish mobsters and Robert De Niro. Actually, I don't know who would have had that time period, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. And the whole thing with this movie is, I mean, the thing about his movies, and especially this one, it's very layered. Like, I kind of forgot how minute, like, it's not like it's a quiet picture, but how minimal dialogue is used and how much they say just with the characters' performances or the music in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's almost like one of those things. It's like, I noticed that just when we were watching Yojimbo and Fistful of Dollars again, too, because both those movies, like, Kira Kurosawa and Sergio Leone both have that kind of thing where, like, they can tell you all about a character and the character doesn't say anything. And I always think that's kind of neat because you just don't see that too often in movies, you know, and so on. They got to have some dialogue or something, but, like, this one you can just hold on a character for a moment and just, like, in that period of time, like, you're going to get this very big explanation of what they're all about.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely the case, too. And the other thing with this movie, it's, like, just the dialogue. There's something about, I don't know, maybe because the dialogue's so sparse and they know when just to put it in, but, like, for being a guy who apparently English wasn't his first language at the time, I don't think it was, at least. Did he speak English while working on For a Few Dollars More?
I think sort of, but like balance? I don't think he ever was great at English. He's always, you know, kind of hardcore Italian. I think he spoke it enough because like the thing is he worked on, not only did he work on Italian movies before he started directing, but he used to also, because whenever they would go and shoot like all the sword and sandals things that they would do over in Italy and Rome and all that kind of stuff, like the Steve Reeves Hercules movies or Ben-Hur and so on like that, he would actually work a lot of times on those movies for, like, the action scenes and so on. So I'm assuming that he, you know, knew enough English by that kind of standard to kind of get by. But I almost want to say that I just remember, like, Clint Eastwood in his book or whatever, in that biography book that's of him, because it's not Clint Eastwood's book, but about him, it said that, like, yeah, that, like, you know, he only spoke a little bit back and forth, just kind of enough to convey it. And at first that was kind of awkward to Clint Eastwood being kind of the only American guy sitting around there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess I was going to say, I mean, he helped came up with the story. It was actually written by a guy named Sergio Donati. And
it's got Dario Argento's also.
Argento.
Like, that was the thing when I was watching again. I was like, whoa, Dario Argento. I'm like, well, you know, that's an Italian name. I mean, I wonder if is that the exact same? I'm like, oh, dude, it is the same guy. It's like the Suspiria guy and like Phenomena, or not Phenomena, no. Was it?
Phenomena?
Yeah, well, not Phenomena. That's a song.
No, but I think it's called Phenomena or something like that. There's a stupid, yeah, we won't go into it.
Yeah, not the song, but yeah, like the...
Yeah, Phenomena.
Yeah, the one that's got Jennifer Connelly in it and so on.
Yeah, like, so there's like she has to kill like the inbred child living in the basement at some point or whatever.
Yeah, and then she like falls backwards into like this pit of like all kinds of insects and so on. It's all real insects and they didn't tell her about it. Well, they probably did. They probably said it in Italian and then pushed her over.
Just go with it. What? Yeah.
You know, but just the idea that, you know, so it makes this movie feel like almost like when you kind of look at it, like especially in like hindsight, when you're just kind of, you know, piecing all that together, it's like, oh, this is almost like a super production Italian movie.
Yeah, yeah.
This is like From Dusk Till Dawn, but with Sergio Leone directing. And Dario Argento.
Well, I was going to say, like, the whole thing with it is how quick and witty the dialogue is, but I think maybe the lack of dialogue in the first place really makes those lines stand out. There's something about a lot of old westerns where, you know, people look at them and they see the grain and they see how old, and people assume they'd be outdated, but they just listen to it. Like, actually, there's a lot of sharp, witty dialogue that's very in and out, you know, and it is usually one-liners of guys trying to sound badass, but still, I mean, it kind of even, like, helps convey things. Like, there's the line where he says, like, there's three of these dusters on the outside of town. He says, like, and? There are three men in the dusters. And? There are three bullets in the men. Just something like that. Or he said it even better than that, but it was just, like, kind of just, like, real quick, raw dialogue like that.
Yeah, no, and I like, but it's like straight to the point. Like every single bit is in there. That's all. It's always like fantastically like chosen words and descriptions of everything. It kind of goes in there, and I guess if you kind of summed up like the short and sweet, simple of the story, is it's, you know, this lady kind of comes to town. She's like, hey, I got this new husband. He's got this great plan of how he's going to make all this money, and what that plan is he bought this little piece of property that nobody cared about at one point in time, just off in the middle of the Arizona desert, just kind of just, you know, out there of nowhere. But it had a well, and underneath it was water, and that was, like, the only water, like, in 100 miles or something like that. And he knew that at some point the train line was going to come through, and since he had that well and that water line there, he could build this whole town around it. So that was part of his investment, you know. And then what happens is that all these people kind of get in on the knowledge of that, and it's just kind of like everybody sort of, like, I guess there's, like, four parties, in a sense, sort of kind of fighting over it. Not saying they're all fighting each other exactly, but, you know, there's kind of four people kind of mixed in this, a little bit more than that even, too. But, you know, four main parties, I would say.
Well, the whole thing, I'll say this. When she first gets there, when the lady first, what's that actress's name?
Claudia Cardinale.
Cardinale, yeah, is Jill. When she first gets there, she's like, can I go to Stillwater? And there's, like, some crusty old fuck with no teeth. Stillwater? Stillwater? What are you going to Stillwater? My husband McBain is there. Oh, that fucking idiot! Oh, Stillwater!
I want to say this real quick. That guy looks like if Jimmy Buffett just happened to, like, not be, like, Jimmy Buffett, like, playing music, but just lived in some, like, ramshackle, like, almost like kind of like a Star Wars like bar and it sells everything in the Old West.
It's like, well, there's no ocean, but there's a lot of sand, so it's the second best thing, the beach.
Yeah, exactly.
But he just, like, and I almost kind of imagine, like, when they're coming back around the corner, because he's laughing at his own joke, which isn't that funny in the first place. Just like, Stillwater! I fucking get it, dude. Jesus Christ. I almost expected, like, as they're coming, as they have the transitional shot, the fadeaway, and you see the car fading back in over. I almost imagine I'm still laughing about it as they're rolling up on the house, but, like,
just, like, fading, like, out.
Yeah, kind of, like, almost, like, for some reason, every time I watch it, I always think that's going to happen. But anyway, going back to this, though, the whole thing is, I think it shows you right off the bat, like, for people, I mean, right now, to us, like, oh, Henry Fonda's the bad guy. But when this movie first came out, it was a big deal because Henry Fonda was always the good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it never opened up with a movie with not him just killing, like, members of a family, but a whole fucking family and shooting a little kid in the face.
Yeah.
Totally having, like, no, like, problem with it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's one of those ones, like, yeah, he kills the father. He kills the older brother. He kills the sister. He kills the little boy. Doesn't give a flying fuck. It's one of those ones, too, when Henry Fonda first showed up, because at first he was like, dude, I don't know about doing this, and Sergio only had to, like, take him out to, like, dinner and tell him all about it. And then even when he showed up the set, like, in Italy and whatnot, he came wearing, like, brown contacts and, like, a mustache and everything like that. Sergio was like, no, you're taking all that off. We want people to see that when you shoot that little boy and the camera pans up to your blue eyes, they know it's fucking Henry Fonda that did it.
Yeah, yeah. I remember hearing that in his story, because he wanted to look roughed up like a villain. But the thing is, he doesn't really, I mean, aside from the hat, aside from the hat he's wearing, he doesn't really look like a villain. But I think that's the thing that stands out about him, aside from how cold and calculating he is, because he is a great villain. But the other thing is, like, when, like, the whole family's already dead, the little brother is the last to come out of the house and see his whole family's dead. And he's just looking at the guy, like, the kid already knows he's fucked. He's just sitting there, like, in disbelief. He's like, and the one guy's like, what do you do, Frank? He's just like, he just pauses for a while. He says, like, well, you call me by name. So he just grabs his gun, just holds it on the kid. And he looks like he doesn't really want to shoot the kid. But at the same time, he doesn't. I can't tell which it is. Like, he doesn't feel that bad about it. Mm-hmm. But he's like, well, we could have not had to kill the kid. But it looks like we got it now. You said my name. But another part of me is almost kind of like he's breathing in, like, he enjoys just seeing the fear in people. Because he has kind of like a faint smirk because he's pulling the gun on the kid.
Yeah, I feel like he probably would have shot the kid anyways, but he wanted to use it as like, hey, well, you just gave me a reason why I have to shoot him now.
That's another good example, too. Well, I'll even say this, because when we first see the family coming in, the family and, like, the dad, like, McBain is just like, guys, get ready for new mom! New mom's gonna be here any fucking minute!
And then, like, the older son's like, Mom, real mom's dead. She died 6 years ago. And then he walks up to him, gives this, like, most stern look, and, like, there's just this dry pause for a moment. Then he grabs the kid, slaps him around. He's like, you get in the fucking buggy, and you go get new mom.
Yeah. Go get her now. How many of you? There's four of you. I've only had sex four times in my fucking life, all right? I just found out on condoms yesterday. fuck!
And I plan on having four more kids with Doom Mom.
That's when you could all get a stick and bindle hit on the fucking road. Jesus, fuck! Like, God, Dad is really pent up right now. He's got a lot riding on. He got the railroad breathing down his neck. Everyone's calling him. He's fucking crazy for coming here, calling it Sweetwater. Like, you talking shit? Like, no, Dad, no, we're fine.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's funny, too, because once that kid gets kind of slapped, it's literally like it slaps some sense into him, and then he's just, like, okay with doing it. It's like...
There is just kind of a lot of that. Like, let me just give you a quick little punch. Like, oh, there you go. That smacks some smarts into you.
Yeah.
So that's also a trademark of the time of these movies. So, but you know,
it is. And well, I feel it's probably also like an Italian thing too, even more ingrained in there too. But just kind of beats him, and then he goes to get it. Of course, that's when you know Henry Fonda and his gang show up and kill him there and whatnot. And then, of course, when what's her name? Claudia shows up there to steal one. Because it's not back in the day where it's like, hey, you know what? You're going to get a message along the way. It's like, nope, you're coming from New Orleans. You're not going to know about this until it's too late. You show up there, and then the whole town, or the whole other town, I guess, is there to be like, oh, yeah, by the way, there was this great picnic that was set up for you. It's going to be a feast of ages, and they're all dead. You know, that's it. Well, is there any food left? Well, no. While we were waiting, we got bored. We decided we might as well not go to waste.
We ate that. Well, at the same time, though, I know that they didn't even know that he had a wife on the way. But the idea of like, yeah, sorry, we already had the funeral. By the time she gets there.
And it's like, well, you know what? We haven't buried everybody yet. I guess you come see that. It's kind of interesting.
Someone bring a shovel? We didn't? Oh, okay. That's going to be a few more days. Yeah, it's like a two-day walk to town. So.
Yeah, so, well, okay. Just kick some dust over them. It's good enough. The crows will get him.
Well, even that whole, because like, there's the whole thing like, that's she's like the thing that no one took account for. Like, oh fuck, we didn't know he had a lady coming in. Well, now we have to deal with her because now all the land goes to her immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have, I guess you'd say four parties, but they're kind of intersecting and changing and moving around. It's kind of like how, like, in Once Upon a Time
Good, Bad,
and the Ugly, how they keep on swapping sides and temporarily helping each other out and screwing each other over. Not to the same level. Like, alliances stay a little bit more the same, but everyone's kind of moving in at their own pace. And there are moments where you think people are screwing each other over or helping each other out, but they have their own ulterior motives for it, ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, because it's also like... Henry Fonda is, working with, like, there's the guy that, who lives in the train, pretty much. He's, like, a crippled who's stuck to a train, almost, in a sense. Which you kind of think about, like, if you're a crippled guy in the 1800s, like, that can't be good.
Fuck, that'd be rough.
Yeah,
people
guy's paralyzed, his neck's broken, whatnot, his back, he's just kind of locked up, and he's just always on either crutches, or he's got these kind of fancy, like, monkey bars in his, like, caboose that he kind of can swing across. Like, well, he doesn't really swing, he just kind of hobbles across, you know? But you got this trained engineer guy, and this guy's always kind of, the way he sort of talks is that, like, he almost makes himself tough, but, like, by being, like, literally, like, Captain Republican, because he's just like, you know what, you think that gun's tough, but here's the thing, slap some money down, right there could stop any gunfight, you know, instantly, you know, look at my money.
Well, that's the thing about Morton, played by Gabriel Frizzetti. He seems like, he is kind of like, he is like your, okay, here's the villain. What is he? Oh, he's the railroad tycoon. Of course, it's going to be the railroad tycoon or the railroad baron or whatever. But then when as it goes on, you realize, oh, this dude doesn't have exactly... I mean, not that he just doesn't have the guts to pull the trigger on some people, but he's literally... He doesn't want him to go about as rough. He wants that land, but he's not going to go about it as rough as he can. Mm-hmm. On top of that, he's done horrible things to get where he's at. And yeah, he doesn't feel good about it, but it's more of like, it's a fucked up world. I got, like, my legs don't work. I have to hire a bunch of people to talk shit to me all day about why I can't play soccer with them, even though they don't even like to play soccer. They just like to, you know, fuck where I'm with me because my legs don't work. But, you know, it's one of those things where the idea that he is just like a very weak person who had to do a lot to get where he is, and all he wants to do is just see the fucking ocean. That's all he wants to do.
Yeah, he's just like, I want my train tracks to get me to the ocean, because there's no way I'm fucking walking there.
Exactly. So it's also like, so his whole, even though he's not by any means my favorite character, I do appreciate they kind of went out of their way to add a little extra, because he could have just been the generic Western villain you see so much, which would have been fine. Just the, oh, the evil money, like the money, like hoarding, you know, railroad guy, but, or, you know, bank baron or whatever. But this case, like, he was actually a person. He was a character. He was somebody who had a lot more layers to him.
Yeah, no, he's definitely well developed and everything like that. And, you know, it's like kind of, it shows that, like, his way is kind of like, he almost, like, in a sense, has to think his way through every problem, because there's no way that he's ever going to be able to, in a sense, be the gunfighter or anything like that. He can't do that. But he can outthink people. He can outbusiness people. You know what I mean? He can use his money to kind of get where he needs to. Like, that, in a sense, is his sort of, like, power and strength, you know? So he kind of has Henry Fonda at first kind of hired as the hired gun, you know, on his side, just to be, like, you know, to protect him and so on, and to be his, you know, gunslinger and so on. And then, of course, you get to, you got Charles Bronson there, who's the harmonica guy, who's pretty much almost, this movie almost feels like it sort of could be, like, the fourth of the Good, Bad, the Ugly, Man of No Name one. Like, you could kind of see that, like, if you almost could have called Charles Bronson's character, like, the Man of No Name still. And I feel like it would fit, like, and I know that, like, Clint Eastwood was asked originally to be in this, and Clint's like, he's like, no, I don't want to get typecast for Westerns next 20 years.
Hello, Joe Kidd. Hello, Pale Rider.
Yeah, exactly. Outlaw Josie Wales. Two, Unforgiven.
Two mules for Sister Sarah.
Yeah, it's just like one of those ones. Like, I don't know what you were thinking, Clint, you know, but, like, I kind of get it. I guess it's like one of those ones. He was maybe looking at the Dirty Harry script coming up or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that, even, like, harmonica, like, that character, because that, if it, that different actor, that very well could have been Clint Eastwood. Like, if Clint Eastwood was in it and played it the same way Charles Bronson did, I think you, even if his clothes looked kind of different, I think there'd be so many theories and people trying to make the comparison. Because he definitely, because every movie Man with No Name is in, he's not referred to as the Man with No Name. He's given a nickname by somebody in that movie, and that's just what he's called, by that nickname. In every movie, it's a different name. So this one, they refer to some asshole playing a harmonica all the time as harmonica.
Yeah.
So it works for that. Now, we forgot to mention the things that everyone seems to bring up, but, like, the first, like, 5-6 minutes of this movie, maybe even longer.
Yeah.
It's just three guys who you can tell are nasty and asshole, like, just nasty pieces of shit, just waiting to fucking kill harmonica at this train station. Like, you can see they're waiting for somebody, and, you know, whatever they're waiting for, it's not going to be good.
Yeah,
like, the guy cracking his fingers the whole time, the dude fucking with the fly, the other dude just sitting there underneath the drippy faucet to drink some water out of his hat.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, too, is because that has this, like, that ultimate, like, build-up to, like, a gunfight that you could possibly have. I mean, yeah, that scene probably might even go on for, like, 10 minutes. I mean, maybe it's not as long as, it feels really long. It probably is maybe only 6 or 7 minutes, but there's just that build-up and the sounds and just the little things like the fly, dripping water, just waiting, and then the train shows up, and at first they're like, well, what the hell, nobody came out of it, you know, and then as the train goes away, of course, Charles Bronson stand on the other side there, you know, and I don't think, he didn't say anything, he just had playing the harmonica, right?
I think he just made him playing his harmonica, and then they say something kind of like, Ring sent you, or something to that effect, and like, they said, like, you bring a spare horse, like, what was it, like, you bring a fourth horse, like, only three... No, only three, or, and then, like, no, you pack too many, or something kind of like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it is, and then, like, you know, it just turns into a quick blast and so on. And, I mean, they're playing the credits and everything along this way and so on. They're, like, it's even, like, this most sparing credits, too, because, like, it'll show some credits, and then it'll be, like, a minute, and you won't see any more credits, and then the credits will start coming back up again, and you're like, oh, okay, we're still going with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's definitely that scene that, like, you know, you could kind of divulge as, like, here's the best way to build tension and also to start off your movie, too.
I feel like this movie, as far as movies I've seen by Sergio Leone, maybe I might not like it as... I got to really think it. I really want to watch the whole, like, Dollars trilogy again.
Mm-hmm.
But watching this, I'll say... I feel like, I don't want to sound like cliche here, I feel like the tension builds a lot more in this one, mm-hmm. just because I find myself caring a little bit more about the characters. Because generally, in Dollars movies, it is just kind of like, You like Clint Eastwood and Clint Eastwood's buddy. Whoever's his sidekick or his partner for that movie, mm-hmm. that's who you're rooting for. Maybe there's like going to be a family member who gets, like, maybe there's going to be some poor civilian who gets tangled in the middle of it, and we're worried for that person. But generally, we don't have all this investment unless it's Clint Eastwood or his partner, for whichever movie it is. This one, you kind of slowly find yourself interested in all the characters. So I kind of, when like, and plus that there's also the overhanging like feeling of like, what the fuck is the connection between Frank and Harmonica? So when that finally comes, the build of the anticipation, it just kind of really, it really works, I think.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and then I guess in the fourth party that we haven't really got to yet is you got Jason Robards there, who pretty much kind of reminds me like he's kind of like the ugly in this movie. If you sort of said that Charles Bronson was the good, you said that Henry Fonda was the bad, he's definitely the ugly, I would definitely say, Jason Robards. Because at first you're not really too sure what he kind of is. Is this guy a bad guy? Is he kind of in between? But he also kind of like does the right thing here and there too. You know, the tension that kind of builds with this character too, he just seems like the loose cannon one.
Cheyenne is probably my favorite character in this movie.
Well, yeah, because he's the guy also too that has a lot of the, like the scenes where he literally is just chewing scenery and whatnot like that, and has the real in-depth conversations and so on. Once again, you just don't know what it is. There's that part where like when Claudia first comes back to the house and she's there by herself, and you know it's in the Old West, so that can't be good to be like an attractive lady out in the middle of nowhere by yourself and so on. And there's that one point where she, you know, she hears a harmonica like in the middle of the night, which just sounds really creepy, just out there and so on. And then whatever, the next day comes up, and when she goes open the door, boom, Jason comes popping in, or Cheyenne, and so on. And then he has this kind of long scene where he's talking and so on, but you just don't know what's really going on here. But he's kind of breaking down, seeing kind of who she is and so on, trying to figure out more about this land opportunity going on.
Well, the reason he got into this, aside from just being the local outlaw, he's pissed off because somebody like attacked. It was kind of like, it's like they weren't Tuscan Raiders, but we're made to believe they were. It's kind of like that. Like they're made to believe that it was Cheyenne's men that tried to kill Charles Bronson, but it wasn't. It was Frank's men who went to go kill him. So because
they had the dusters,
right. So he's sure,
he must have his name brand dusters. Like he came in with like like a stock car company and just had all like his sponsors on it or something.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no, take it off. My mom made it for me. Fuck your mom. You're with Cheyenne now.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but like it's at the same time, it's like that whole like. So that's his whole thing. His whole thing is just trying to find out who's impersonating his men, who's given his team a bad name. And his first introduction, it's like all the smallest details. Like you said, he chews a lot of scenery, and he does to an extent, but it's like he chooses a lot of scenery, yet it's very minimal. Like he just kind of lingers around, and it kind of works about everything about him. Like I love the thing, like, you know, because at some point, Claudia ends up, I think at the halfway point, I don't remember if it's before or after her family's killed. But she goes into like this bar in the middle of nowhere, and she's having a conversation with this guy, and this guy just yapping away. They hear gunfire outside. Cheyenne just comes walking in. He grabs a bottle, and you see he still has his fucking like handcuffs on. So oh, okay, all right. And then the idea of like there's some guy who looks like the guy's got a gun on him, but he looks like a little bit more of like a dandy, like he's a city guy trying mm-hmm. to be. Like a Wild West man. Like, one time he's reached for his gun, Cheyenne's like, don't do it. And the other time he cocks the gun, turns back to him, like, hey, and just already has a gun. Like, he's like, take mine. And it's like one of those things, like, he so could have killed the guy right there. He would have been in his right to do it also. But at the same time, he just uses the guy to help him shoot the chain. Like, thank you, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Just to kind of blast it off and sort of free him and so on. Yeah, that's the whole thing. Is like, this character the whole time, you're just like, wait a second, who is this outlaw guy? Well, like, what's his motives for all this and so on? He really is just coming in because he sort of got blamed. And I guess you could almost say that comes back to the train guy once again, too. Because he was sort of like, hey, well, you know what? To keep our name good, you got to kind of blame it on an actual outlaw that nobody's going to care about and so on. And then once the Henry Fonda kind of screws that up, you know, and people kind of catch on, it's like, wait a second, what'd you do wrong there, Henry? I thought you said you had this covered.
I'll say something about Henry Fonda's character. he is very intimidating, and he is a great character. But watching this movie, the first time I remember watching this movie, I remember him being like super badass the whole time and super intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
And he is intimidating and all that. But watching this, you realize, oh, as deadly as he is, he's kind of a shit heel. He keeps fucking up, and he keeps on overreaching in ways, and like not in like just the, and not just in a how do I put this? Not like in a totally reasonable way, mm-hmm. but in a way of like he keeps on thinking that he can do what everyone else does, because he has a little bit of envy for Gabriel Frizzetti's character, Morton, the railroad baron.
Mm-hmm.
He has envy for him, but at the same time, he fucking hates him. He can't respect him because he has, like, he's just weak. He doesn't respect the, like, he's a cripple. What the fuck is the cripple gonna, why am I working for the cripple? That's kind of his idea. And he just sees how much money he has. Like, he's right. Can't kill him as long as he has all the fucking money.
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, he just does not like this, kind of despises this guy. Just thinks it almost in a sense he can kind of work everything around just by being, in a sense, a weak character and so on like that, of not being able to take care of anything himself without having somebody else do it for him.
And the idea he's slowly trying to, like, he kind of realizes, like, he probably could kill Morton and probably could take his business or whatever, but mm-hmm. he'd fuck it up probably in a matter of a few months. That's the thing with him, because he's a killer, he's not a businessman.
Yeah, and that's about the only thing that Henry Fonda really is good at. You know, nothing else beyond that. He's just almost like a one-trick pony.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing, because I didn't realize that totally the first time around, even though the movie blatantly says, like, well, you're learning a lot of things you're not good at, you know? and this one, this time around, I really kind of did see, oh, yeah, he is, like, it's not to the level of, like, Kylo Ren, where it's like, oh, this guy's going to be scary. Oh, no, he's not. Fuck him. It's a little bit more of like, oh, no, he is scary. He is good at what he does, but he's good at what he does. He's not good at anything beyond that.
Yeah, no, he can't do anything else there and so on. I mean, even there's that scene kind of later on, too, where Charles Bronson sort of kind of, it's like he gets himself captured on the Railroad Baron's thing and so on, but he's just more there to, like, investigate and see the show from the inside out. And then you also got Jason Robards' character comes in kind of like trying to break in, you know, because now this is when he's discovered that this is the guy who framed him and so on like that. And that's a cool shootout and so on, where like he's hanging down from like the train from the top and like kind of looking in through the window, checking, scoping things out, taps on the window, waits for that guy to notice, and then blows him around the head.
And then there's even the part when he's like, he's fucked with him by running from one side of the train to the other, and people are like, well, okay, they're looking up at the ceiling, getting ready, and then he starts, like, bringing his boot down to the window seal.
Oh,
the
yeah,
guy's
yeah.
getting closer, gets shot right in the fucking face. Then you see him pulling, he had his hand in his boot with his gun.
Yeah, there's just some really cool, like, scenes like that, where he's just coming in like that, just surprising these guys and taking them out, and just showing how almost how crafty and clever he is.
And, yeah, his character, like, there's no character in this. Like, even the Railroad Baron, I didn't dislike. I think, because really, when it gets down to the end of it, I mean, yeah, there's, you scroll through the cast, there's a lot of people, there's, well, not that many people, but there's a handful of people that stand out. But the thing is, really, it comes down to just four people at the end of the day in this movie. Four or five people.
Yeah.
There's the Railroad Baron, then there is, Jill McBain, played by Claudia, and then there's Frank by Henry Fonda, Harmonica by Charles Bronson, and then Jason Robards as Cheyenne.
Yeah.
Basically, those are your five people right there. Everybody else is just more of a passing character.
Yeah, just extra gangsters, some people to get shot along the way, and just townsfolk, and, you know, kind of like that. There's not really any of the main characters in that, but everybody's going after that piece of land, and just kind of you're seeing the crafty ways they kind of go with it. And also, at the same time, it's almost like the other way, too, is you're always wondering the whole way through. You're like, wait a second, what is Charles Bronson's whole thing with getting involved in all this? You know? Because he just sort of is drifting in and just, like, you know, you just kind of wonder. Like, cause I even sort of forgot. I'm like, I can't remember exactly why Charles Bronson exactly is until you're kind of getting into the movie. And then you're going, oh, it's because Henry Fonda killed his brother.
Well, that whole part right there, like, that's the thing. Nobody can figure him out because he is, like, sure, Jill McBain was a little bit of, like, the wild card to their plan because they didn't expect him to have a wife,
mm-hmm.
so for all the residents to go to and all that. But at the exact same time, they're like, where is this asshole coming in? It should be between us, the criminal, and the lady. That's who this should be. Who the fuck is this guy? Why is he here? Is he working with the lady? Is he working with Cheyenne? What the fuck? You know, there's that whole thing. Or did they initially... Actually, that brings up one quick question. Did they originally hire him for something? Because there's guys waiting there for him. Did they clarify what that was all about? There's guys waiting there to kill him at the beginning.
Yes, yeah, so I don't know if it ever does clear. I think
he was going to work for Frank, but then Frank's just like, we don't need him or whatever, or something to that effect, or...
Maybe that sort of was it, like he was. I don't know, yeah, because they were obviously there to, like, kill him and so on like that.
Yeah,
And he knew it was coming. It almost feels like there's almost, like, this, like, intro movie that, like, explains all this, but I can't think of it. It's probably what's in, like, the Italian director's cut version. I don't know.
If I had to theorize, I think it's probably something to the effect of he was going there to go after Frank, but he was acting as if he was going to go there for a job. And then in that process, they wanted to make it look like Cheyenne's guys are at it again. So let's go cause some damage over here, then we'll go cause some damage over there. So if I had to guess, that's probably... That's my headcanon.
That sounds most logical, that it was just more things to kind of put the blame on Cheyenne so that nobody else would ever suspect that the railroad baron had anything to do with trying to take this land over.
And he has such a way of making great backhanded compliments where he's like, you remind me of my mother. She was a whore and the greatest woman in the whole goddamn world, you know, and then goes on to say, like, whoever my father was, for a minute, for an hour or a month, he had to be the happiest man alive. Like, there's sometimes those things where it's just like how backhanded that sounds at the same time. You know he means it most sincerely as possible.
Yeah, exactly, because it is, like, it's like he's giving compliments, but it's like, yeah, I think it's because you learn that later on that Jill McMahon is just like, in a sense, like, Dad was just out in, you know, New Orleans, and he just picked up a hooker and decided to marry her, and that's how we're getting the new mom. That's probably why, like, the oldest son's like, Dad, you just married a hooker and brought her back. Like, it's not real, Mom.
Shut the fuck up. You don't know how badly I need this.
Yeah, it's like with Dad just leaves the kids there for a bit, just like going off on, like, he's like, I'm going off on a fuck spree in New Orleans.
Dinner's in the fridge.
Yeah,
the ice box.
The ice box, whatever. Like
the wooden barrel we keep ice in.
Yeah, exactly.
It's probably melted by now. Fuck it, it's your problem.
Make sure the fire doesn't go out until I get back.
Go. You have to go chop down a cactus for firewood or some shit. I don't know what to tell you.
So it's like, so I think that's also where, like, it comes back into thinking that, like, Jill McMahon be like, oh yeah, it's like, so it's like almost like in a sense, like, for her, I guess, like, was one's like, hey, I, you know, you don't have to be a hooker anymore. You can come live in, like, I don't know if that's better than New Orleans area. Come live out in the middle of the desert with nothing. And my three kids you can take care of that you obviously don't know how to, you know, do any of this yet, but you'll figure it out. I was going to have the youngest one teach you, but that's over now.
Yeah, so much for that. This movie, thinking about it back on it now, as we're talking about it, it almost could be, like, part of the thing that really makes it stand out is, like a lot of Sergio Leone movies, the action is not, like, nonstop, but when the action does happen, it's really hard-hitting, and he really builds up the suspense.
Mm-hmm.
If you take away the grandiose action and the sets, this almost feels like it could be just like a simple play, really.
Yeah,
just for how few characters are in it, really.
Where they just walk back and forth to different rooms and kind of talk, and, you know, this character betrays this character and so on. Like, yeah, I mean, like, granted, it probably wouldn't be that interesting without the action scenes in it. I feel like you'd be,
yeah,
that, like, that's what you sort of need to kind of keep it going and so on, is to have those really sweet action scenes here and there. You know, it's like when the action does happen, it's real intense. Like, I mean, there's also that other cool scene where Charles Bronson is, in a sense, like, helping out. Henry Fonda's character is going to get assassinated when he's in town and whatnot. And he's kind of, and Charles Bronson's sort of watching from the window and almost is taking out these guys along the way. And they have this one scene where he's trying to find him. And the guy's, like, poking through, like, this theater banner or whatnot with, like, a sniper rifle. And so on. He's like, you just barely can see it, and so on. And along the way, he's kind of covering him and taking him out, all the way to the point that, like, makes him survive that Jill kind of looks at him and is like, yo, what'd you just do? You just saved his life. He's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. There's a difference between I didn't save his life. You know, I was just like, you know, waiting for another moment, you know, because I don't want them to kill him. I want to be the one to kill him. He says it better than that, but you know.
Yeah, he says there's a difference between saving a man's life and not letting him die or something like that. Or it was something like, because he doesn't really, I think if you put all of like, all of Charles Bronson's lines together, it makes one paragraph. That's the thing about, that's something that like this movie is so, that I give it so much credit for, is just because how minimal dialogue and how their performances and the way it's shot and the music, I know I said this already, just gets their personality across so on. Like, I feel like I know Charles Bronson more than like certain Star Wars characters that like have hours of dialogue. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's like,
you just appeared in multiple movies.
Yeah, he just gets it across just right away, and just like all the lines, just like they're all just like the perfect chosen ones. He just doesn't have to say anymore, and so on.
There is an example I was going to make. And just to go back, I wasn't like, yeah, they should make this into a play with less violence.
I know what you mean by that, but you know what I mean. Like,
What helps sell it is a lot of the action and the buildup and the grandioseness of it all.
I'll say, if it was a play like the old Wild Wild West show in Universal Studios, and it was just the long version of that, so you had all the great stunts still and everything, and maybe even have a train come crashing through at some point.
Like, well, we just took a cue from the Waterworld exhibit.
Yeah, exactly, you know.
I was going to say, the other thing about it, though, is that the pacing of it is almost interesting, because it is, like, I got to watch it again, and it's not meant to be literally, but I guess just tonally and story beats, I guess it is, but apparently, Inglourious Basterds is meant to be somewhat of a World War II remake of this. And I think there's enough differences in there not to call it a flat-out remake.
Mm-hmm.
But I can kind of, watching this movie now, and going off what I remember about Inglourious Basterds, I can kind of see thematic similarities here and there. But something about it that really stood out to me is it doesn't have, like, the big grand set piece, or kind of does. It doesn't have the big grand set piece with the main character shooting a bunch of guys to get to the lady. It has Henry Fonda fighting off some guys that went against him. So the big last action scene of the movie is the big one, is Henry Fonda and his own men. And then we cut to later, we go to, it's a much more like emotional scene, but the Charles Bronson and Henry Fonda fight they have, where it is like a lot of long build up, and they do have the whole like that like standoff.
Yeah, and they also got the flashbacks where you finally figure out what's going on. It's almost like the set piece that they got going, design of like where it shows like the flashbacks of like Charles Bronson there of his brother, and the way that they got him hung is that there's like this archway and there's a bell there, and like his brother is being hung from the bell, and underneath him, Charles Bronson as a boy has to stand there and hold his brother up on his shoulders, and pretty much if one of the other gives out, you know, then he'll come falling down and hang himself in a sense. So it's just, as long as Charles Bronson can kind of hold his weight, you know, he can live. But is, you know, as it goes back and forth and building back and back, and you see this shot of like Henry Fonda slowly walking up towards the camera and whatnot, his brother finally kicks out Charles Bronson from below and hangs himself. And, well, and the whole time, Charles Bronson has this harmonica that Henry Fonda has shoved in his mouth.
You know, play a song for your sweet old brother, something like that.
Yeah, and then as, you know, he falls to the ground into the dirt and so on like that. That's like when, like, Henry Fonda, like, who are you? What is this? And so on. And, you know, Charles Bronson just takes that harmonica, shoves it in his, you know, mouth after he shot him, and just, like, he falls over and dies. And it's like that last moment of life, it's like, oh, fuck, it's that guy.
And his face, unless he's like, hits
well,
the ground.
He's like, well, I do that to a lot of guys. You know what I mean? It's my thing. Yeah. I find an archway. I hang him up. I get a significant other to hold him up by the shoulders, and I put a harmonica in there. You got to be a little bit more specific.
I lucked out with you. It's usually the height difference is massive, so it doesn't really end up panning out. But you guys just panned out perfectly. I also have a whole like storeroom of harmonicas. So, but like, it's like the whole thing is like, that whole part, because when his face hits the ground, you see his eyes. Like, I bet people back then weren't used to seeing Henry Fonda die wide-eyed, face down into the dirt. Maybe that's one of his most famous roles that I don't know about. But I feel, but if I had to guess, at the time, that wasn't probably a very common way to see him go out.
Well, I want to say this. This is the first time that Henry Fonda ever played a villain. And I almost want to say, two, this is the first time that a big American actor ever played, you know, that was always a hero, played, you know, a heel instead.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like, somebody else might have done it, but I mean, like, they really just, like, totally change it on there, like a real bad guy. Maybe not, like, a bad guy, like, in the show, you know, like, something like that, where they're just playing the heavy, like, I guess it's all Once Upon a Time in Hollywood style. I mean, full on, like, in a movie and have it be like, oh, what the fuck? They got Henry Fonda gets, you know, starring credit role, but he's the villain?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is kind of weird, because I always think it's weird, because you look at the credits, and, like, Charles Bronson's name always comes up kind of last, and it's always like, I mean, I know that, I guess at that time period, he's always been kind of like the secondary actor in all the movies. He hasn't done a single starring role, but it's like, I would almost say this is like the one where it's like, if anybody's the main character, it's obviously Charles Bronson.
Yeah, well,
I mean, there's a lot of characters. I mean, and I know it's an ensemble, but like, I feel like he almost is kind of, I mean, in a sense, Jill McMahon is why everything happens, of course, but I feel Charles Bronson, as far as the movie kind of is, he's kind of our, like, in a sense, our person we're kind of following around, our hero.
Well, the other thing is, like, the whole beginning with, just going back to that, casting people, well, some cases against type, but other cases really kind of throwing people a curveball. Like, the idea of way he used, I think it was Woody Strode, Jack Elam, and Salvatore Basile, probably mispronouncing that, sorry. I think Salvatore was the last of the third guys.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them, I think Woody Strode and Jack Elam, I don't know if they were huge, but they're at least known actors that were in Westerns. I don't think they were Henry Fonda big, or maybe not even like Charles Bronson big, but they were like known. And you see them right there in the opening. Their names are like in like the opening and all that, I believe. So the idea that you see them and then see them get taken out, like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, this is going to be a very weird comparison, but I feel like it's kind of like when people are going to see, like, the first Mission Impossible and then see, like, Emilio Estevez die so quickly into it.
Yeah, exactly. Then it makes you start questioning, like, wait, was that actually Emilio Estevez? I can't imagine. He literally just, like, came off the Mighty Ducks. They wouldn't have killed him off that quickly, would they?
Exactly.
You know, yeah, I think that's sort of what it was. I think that was the thing, is Sergio Leone wanted that kind of, like, he wanted that real shock value to kind of happen. You know, whether it be those kind of big actors dying right in the first scene, whether it be Henry Fonda being the bad guy, you know, all these things that, you know, in a sense, because realistically, you know, you always kind of forget, but, like, you know, Sergio Leone is the guy who, like, really changed Westerns, you know, real hardcore, you know.
Now, I'll say this, and this is going to be this might sound kind of like shitty and kind of close-minded, but at the time, people, this movie did not do good, and people are like, what the fuck is this? And it's like, I guess the time, like, because I want to say this, like, if somebody was to watch this now, and they're just like, I'm just not into Westerns, like, okay. But for a Western fan to be like, what's this horse shit? I'm like,
yeah.
I'm sorry, are you fucking stupid?
Yeah.
You know? I just kind of want to say that to, like, people of that time. Like, it's one of those things, like, I know I wasn't there for it, and it's something radical, and there were times where I've seen something and then appreciated it more later, but at the exact same time, like, oh, these fucking Italians can't make some fucking what? What do they fucking know? You're like, no. Did you watch the same fucking movie? Are we watching? Because I don't understand how, like, this movie was considered just, like, was dismissed as, like, a bomb. Well, I mean, did it make money, I guess. But how this movie was dismissed for so long, you know?
Yeah, well, you know what I think? I think it was sort of like a slight World War II mentality. Like, the idea that the guys you just went and fought are now making the movies that you fucking love. I think that sort of is what it kind of was. Because really what made Sergio Leone movies popular was, in a sense, like, I feel like people like our parents' age. Like, that was the people that, like, in a sense, that, like, it was sort of made for. It was made for, like, the 60s kids, you know, and give or take, you know, kids in their teens and 20s and so on. Like, that was kind of the target audience and so on, because it's like, hey, here's this new thing. It's more violent. You know, there's more bad guys. It's the anti-heroes, you know, and so on like that. And that's not saying that, like, because, you know, sometimes some people also have this thing, too, that they think that in a sense, Westerns before The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and, like, Fistful of Dollars aren't good at all. And that's not true. It's like, you can watch, there's great 30s, 40s, 50s Westerns that are, that can be, you know, still violent and still have dark meanings and all kinds of stuff in there. Like, people sometimes make it out like they're all, like, almost like TV Westerns where everybody has, like, a smile on their face and there's a white hat and a black hat and, like, that kind of, like, almost, like, carbon-copied, like, cereal box characters, but... No, there is ton. I mean, the shit. I remember there's one thing called Broken Arrow with, like, Jimmy Stewart in it in the 50s, and Jimmy Stewart just goes, like, murdering people left and right when, like, they kill his wife in that movie.
I haven't seen that, but that's been one I've been meaning to check
out. I think it's called Broken Arrow. I know that. I get that kind of confused because then there's that John Woo movie called Broken Arrow with John Travolta and Christian Slater, but I could have swore that's what the Jimmy Stewart one's called, too.
Yeah, I'll be 100% honest with you. Most of my Westerns, in all honesty, kind of start like 60s and onward. I really got to probably do some more 50s and 40s Westerns just to vary myself up. Most of it kind of starts with more of like Clint Eastwood, Robert Redford, Paul Newman. Like basically everybody that the Greatest Generation and Sleeper Generation fucking hated. The baby boomers like, hey, they're pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of that stuff. No, as I said, it's worthwhile to go. There is a lot of like really good old-timey Westerns that are, like, fun to watch and so on. I'm, you know, granted, I mean, the Sergio Leone stuff is literally, like, as top-notch as you kind of can get, you know, along with, like, Sergio Cabucci and whatnot, or whatever. The guy who did Django, the original one, and those other, like, kind of, like, spaghetti Westerns of the time period. And I feel like that's literally what makes, like, the Clint Eastwood Westerns of, like, Outlaw Josie Wales and so on. Like, that doesn't happen, in a sense, without, like, Sergio Leone.
Going back to, like, Jill McBain for a second... Mm-hmm. I think they did for a lot of times. I think people will be like, oh, yeah, well, this seems kind of aggressive. Well, for the time, it was actually pretty open minded to have a character that was a whore have some agency and be able to, like,
turn her life around.
Turn her life around and command a room a bit, you know?
Yeah, well, I know, because that was a big deal at the time period, too, because in a sense, like, you know, that's sort of your, realistically, story wise, is your main character. I feel kind of like. What we're watching it, Charles Bronson is, but she, once again, she holds everything together and so on like that. So she's kind of how it is. And in a sense, she's going to run this whole business without any of these men. She's going to take care of it. You know, I mean, take care of all these people and so on and build this town. You know, one of the ones like, kind of like, well, shit, I guess I'm here. Like, I ain't going back to fucking New Orleans.
Yeah. Yeah. You have no idea how expensive those tickets were.
Yeah, exactly, you know, so it's like, yeah, like, here's this lady that really takes over. I mean, like, the only thing I guess it could have topped is if she was firing a gun herself, too.
That would have been the sequel.
Yeah, that probably would have been, well, yeah. You know.
But, yeah, no, this movie, I remember when I first saw it, I really liked it, but second time around, or third time around, or fourth time, whatever this is, I found myself liking it a lot more. I don't know if I'd say it's my favorite out of all Sergio Leone's movies. Mm-hmm. It's definitely in my top 10 Westerns. Definitely that. I mean, it was already, if I thought hard on it, I'm like, that could probably make it, but watching it, no, it definitely is somewhere in my top 10 favorite Westerns. I'm glad we covered this right here.
Yeah, well, because this is one of those ones I've been kind of thinking, like, man, I'd really like to rewatch this again. It's been way too long. You know, I kind of told, it's almost been so long that I kind of forgotten, so I thought, I was like, dude, well, let's do this one on the podcast, you know? And this is one of those movies, it sounds weird, like, I remember kind of growing up, and this movie was in that kind of category of, like, okay, these are, like, the pinnacle class, well, that too, but, like, the pinnacle classic movies, you know? Citizen Kane, you know, Gone with the Wind, Once Upon a Time in the West, Psycho, you know, Godfather, like, Jaws, like, it was in that kind of thing. But as time has kind of gone on, this movie, I just feel, doesn't get brought up nearly as much as it once used to be. You know, I don't know if it's just kind of gotten older, and, you know, I mean, it's a Western, and we all know the Westerns in general don't get brought up, but I think it's kind of, I'm not saying people have forgotten about it, but it doesn't feel like it, you know, people still remember Citizen Kane and all those other movies I named off, but this one doesn't seem to get brought up in that list as much as it once did.
I feel like it's something to the effect of people still really like the Beatles, because the Beatles are still around, or two members of them are, yeah. And the group of the Beatles are still around. I think the second they go away, the second that generation dies off, we might start hearing them a little less. Might take some time because they have a bigger impact, but might be a little less. I think that as people, as, you know, baby boomer generation gets older, a lot of those favorite movies kind of, and more movies come out, some of those movies get pushed back. This movie, Citizen Kane, Jaws, those movies are always going to be on a list, and they're always going to be movies that are probably referenced to for someone to watch in a film class or something to that effect. But I think that there are those movies we just named off that people aren't going to want to give the time of day because it's too old. They can't, you know, when I was younger, I had a little bit more of a bias on old movies. I don't anymore, but when I was probably like 10, 15, yeah, until I saw Kill Bill, which made me want to check out older kung fu movies and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so, but I just kind of noticed this time, is I don't hear this movie brought up as much. I think I don't, you know, you still, the good, the bad, and the ugly still always gets referenced, and I think that's the one it kind of, it's kind of weird, because this movie was probably the one that, like, at first, I mean, maybe not exactly when it came out, but at first was like, oh shit, this is just like Sergio Leone dialed in as much as possible, but as time has kind of come on, or gone on, I feel the good, the bad, the ugly is the one that's kind of like became like the ultra cult classic, you know, remembered Western one.
Yeah, I'm glad we did this one. I kind of makes me want to watch his other movies too, and I don't know, it makes me want to do like you. Maybe I should probably say this after the show. Maybe we could do Wild Bunch at some point.
I would love... That's another one, because I probably haven't watched that movie in 10 years either, so I wouldn't... It's like... I feel like I'm at that point right now where it's like, you know... So I know this person you only notice once you get kind of older, but there comes that point where, like, once it goes by, like, a decade and you haven't seen something for a while, you're like, shit, I gotta go back and check all these things out again. Like, it's just been way too long.
Well, there was a point where I would just, for comfort food, I'd put on one of my favorite, like probably one of my favorite like 30 movies of like early, like my early 20s. One of my favorite 30 of movies. So that probably would have been like any Tarantino movie, any Robert Rodriguez movie with the exclusion of the Spy Kids shit. Any like, you know, any like kind of like Sergio Leone movie, Bruce Lee movie, Cowboy Bebop, Star Wars, you know. So, it's kind of like, so, and this movie was one of those, not as much as the other ones, but it was one I watched a couple times back then, and it did stick with me, but at the same time, it's also like, you kind of remember, oh yeah, there's a reason why I watch these movies so much. There's a point where you kind of maybe overwatch them in that time period, but then you come back to like, oh no, this movie was really good, you know, or this movie does, this is probably one I probably should have watched more than maybe... Duck, you sucker, or whatever, you know?
Yeah, and well, I think also, too, what it is, it's just, there's just so much, you know, you just keep watching new movies, and you keep going down different paths, and so on, and then next thing you know, it's not that you didn't really want to watch, just, you know, there's only so much time in the day to watch so many movies. You know, probably, if you're lucky, if you really think about it, the maximum amount of movies that you probably can watch, unless you just got a lot of real free time, is 365 movies a year, if you just watch one movie a night. But I know a lot of times that I split my movies up between 2 days, so... 2 or 3 days, so I probably only watch half that, if not less than that, when you kind of think about it at the end of the day. So, you know, in an entire year, you might only be able to watch, you know, 100 to 150 movies a year. That's not really a whole lot when you think of it.
It's true.
You know, when you count going to the cinemas, you know, something new comes out, and then you're kind of going with something old, something you've never seen before that you want to see, something that someone recommends, something that someone else forces on you. Not saying that that's a bad thing, but you know what I mean. There's all these things that take up this, you know, sort of like, you know, what a lot of time you sort of have.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how like,
oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and it's almost like, the nice thing about a podcast, though, is it kind of gets you that, like, hey, we can force ourselves. We'll give us a reason to, like, go back to something.
Exactly. Well, also, going back to, like, say, like, Westerns, like Once Upon a Time in the West or The Wild Bunch, they're either really short or really long.
Yeah.
So that's the thing about it. And it is probably hard for some people to watch a movie like Wild Bunch, where it's just like half the movie is old dudes on horseback just kind of bitching about how times are changing. But something about it's really entertaining, you know?
Yeah.
But the violence, that thing is just straight up murder porn when it gets to like the last 30 minutes.
Well, it's because it's just Sam Peckinpah, and it's just so good.
It's really, we got to do that at some point. I don't know when. We got to do it at some point. But, like, the last, like... That's, like, one of the greatest shootouts in any movie. The last, like, 10 minutes of that movie. And it's, once again, not to the same level as... Leone's, like, implied... Like, not... What's implied about the Pete characters in that, but... The last bit of the movie, it's just like, okay, you already kind of know what's going to happen before it happens, but it all works perfectly.
Yeah, exactly. No. It's totally like that. Speaking of even just of those movies being long, I don't know why. That kind of reminded me is like, I remember watching, I think it was like it wasn't the first time I saw Good, Bad, and the Other, but it was the first time I got it on DVD or whatnot. And I remember just, I think Cisco left and I was watching the movie and whatnot. And it was like daytime and whatnot. And he comes back and I'm still watching the movie. He's like, you're still watching the movie? It's like nighttime out now. It's like, I know, it's like 3 hours long.
And every hour of it is worth it.
Oh, and every hour is amazing. That's like how that movie sort of is. You know, just like how this movie is. This movie's like long. And there's actually a longer version because there's a, like, it looks like in Italy, there's like an extra 10 more minutes here. And for some reason, they say that, like, that version just never really comes out to the U.S. Like, so there's, like, the original U.S. version, which is not on the... Because you have the two-disc DVD, if I'm assuming, the same one I have.
Yeah, but apparently, I'll be honest,
apparently that's got the international cut, so that's, like, the medium-cut version. But then there's an Italian-only version. I don't know, what's in this Italian-only version? Like,
God, just...
Just be like, oh, you know, it's like one of those weird things like China, where it's like, well, it has to have some Chinese-ness to it, so... You know, the Italian version to be shown here, it's got to show, you know, somebody, like, working in a vineyard and some guy making a pizza. So, like, dude, that just sounds like what an American thinks an Italian does.
Well, that's what American paid for, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'll be in Italy pretty soon, so I can maybe go on the hunt for it while I'm there.
Go search for it there. Well, yeah, who knows, because it's like, if Italy's like Spain always for some reason gets, like, all, like, the extra versions that you, for some reason, nobody else gets. I don't know why. I don't know if they just like, well, you know, we can just test it out on Spain, see what happens.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, it'd be kind of fun to track down that version, you know, just to see what those extra 10 minutes are. You know, I mean, it could also be, because I will say this is the one thing, and I guess we can start wrapping this one up, but this movie's not nearly as violent in a sense, like gore-wise, as the other ones are. It's almost like toned down comparatively. I mean, it's violent because, like, a kid gets shot and so on like that, but it's not like, there's no blood... should be kind of spurting out or anything like that, or any of that kind of violence I notice in this one. And the weird thing is, because the other movies are all rated R, this movie's originally only PG, but it's re-rated later in life to PG-13, which is kind of bizarre.
Yeah, that is kind of weird. Well, I think it's one of those things where at the time, the idea of killing a child in a movie, even if they don't even, like, there's no blood or screaming or anything, the idea of killing a child movie, you can't do that, people will walk out. Now somebody's like, they better show that fucking kid getting killed, you know?
Yeah, so be like,
I paid good money for this, I want to see,
like,
that
assault on Precinct 13. Can I get a chocolate covered swirls or whatever?
You forgot my sprinkles. I rewinded that part like three times when I first saw that movie, like dying of laughter.
That's like one of my favorite parts of that movie and so on. Oh, so hilarious. But Once Upon a Time in the West, a good one. It'd be kind of fun. I mean, we don't have to obviously do this next podcast or something, but like in the future to do some more Once Upon a Time movies, because, you know, there's Once Upon a Time in America, if you feel like you got 4 hours and 20 minutes or whatever the hell that is. You know, got shit. It's one of those ones where you got to get up and switch DVDs at some point.
Once Upon a Time in Mexico.
There's Once Upon a Time in Mexico. Then there's also Once Upon a Time in China, or Wong Fei Hung, as it's called in China. But with Jet Li, that movie's amazing. Actually, like, all three... I think there's, like, five of them, but I only have the first three of them. And all three of those ones are super good.
And there's Once Upon a Time, the ABC show, but we're probably going to browse over that one.
Oh, yeah, there's that one, too.
We'll probably pass by that.
I feel like there's one other one that I'm missing. I just cannot think of it off the top of my head.
Once Upon a Time in the Bronx.
Oh, yeah, there is. That's right. I bet you there's probably another one. I bet you look hard enough, there's kind of is. But it'd be kind of fun just to, like, go through, like, at least some of them. Maybe if not all of them, but just kind of, like... You know, dive into that. As well as I wouldn't mind seeing that. I always want to see that original Sergio Leone movie, too. Like, the Sword and Sandals type one that he does. Because just the idea... Because, you know, in a sense, like, all his movies... It's kind of weird. It's like, they're all Westerns. Six of them, and then one gangster movie, you know? And that's all he sort of has. Like, it's the strangest thing to think this guy... I mean, I know he's an assistant director and many other, like... His name's on a bunch of other stuff, too, just not as a main writer-director. But the fact that this guy's almost like such a legendary guy and he only has seven movies is such a bizarre thing to think about.
Well, it was probably like, you know what? I told the stories I wanted to tell, and I feel like I did a good job at all of them. So I don't really give a shit. I'll help you direct this, or I'll produce that, or whatever, just to pay the bills. But I already told the stories I want to tell, because I don't see how he'd have trouble. Holy shit, he was an assistant director on Bicycle Thieves.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, he's on some other stuff kind of big. It's
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm just flipping through this, and like, yeah, because he is in a lot of stuff, but...
Sergio Leone says that he directed the chariot chase in Ben-Hur. Some people kind of question that, but...
Maybe? Who knows? It's kind of hard to say. I'm just saying this now. It's hard to say, this thing I just now found out about. No, but like, I mean, I guess I could possibly see that, because he is uncredited on a lot of things here, but... Yeah.
So, I mean, like, he is in a lot. And it's weird because also it's like after Duck, You Sucker, it's like 14 years until, like, Once Upon a Time in the West or America comes out. Or it might even be later than that, too.
Yeah, Once Upon a Time in America. When does that pop up?
I think it's like 84, 86 maybe.
Yeah, that's a jump. Oh, fuck, yeah. That's a big jump right there.
Yeah, 84.
71 to 84, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's just kind of amazing that, like, it's been like that long. And then he pretty much passes away just a little bit past that, but...
He's like, I got one more story to tell.
Well, and that's the one that he always wanted to do, and everybody kept, like, saying, no way, you know, and this, he never got to do it, and so on. But yeah, one of those ones. There's just many kinds of cool things like that, too, and then whatever he else was on. But it'd be fun to check out some more Sergio Leone movies as the future kind of goes on in the podcast. But yeah, beyond all that fun stuff. Let's go to oldmanorange.com. Let's more podcasts, comic books like Pizza Boys with new season 3 out. And all kinds of other old fun stuff that we got on there. I'm Spencer Scott Holmes.
And I'm Ryan Dunnigan.
And we'll see you some other time.
Later, folks.